Let me begin with a question. Do you think that Uzzah was a little hard done by in that passage? Or Mikkel, for that matter? Are they being a little hard done by here? So to begin with, what's Uzzah doing? He's simply playing his part in David's celebration before the Lord. I mean, that's a good thing, is it not? Now, you need to remember, he's the guy that has been partly responsible for looking after the ark for the last 20 years. It's been housed in his home, okay? And when the ark looked like it was about to fall on the ground, all he did was reach out his hand to stop it from falling, and he gets struck down on the spot for his troubles. Or there's Mikkel, okay? So as daughter of King Saul, she grew up in the palace. So she knows about royal etiquette, about bringing dignity to the office of king. And what she does, albeit in a somewhat scornful and unhelpful way though, but all she does is remind the king that dancing in the street with commoners is not becoming for the office of king. And for her troubles, she is punished by the Lord, we presume, with one of the worst disgraces in ancient times. That's childlessness. So were Uzzah and Mikkel hard done by here? Now, fortunately for we humans, God does not strike people down like this very often. Even in the Bible, it doesn't happen very often. There are two occasions that followed the Exodus. So remember, the Exodus is where Israel basically became a nation. And while they're in the desert, two of the priests, Nadab and Abihu, we're told offered, unauthorized fire before the Lord in Leviticus 10. And then on another occasion, a guy called Korah and a whole bunch of his associates opposed Moses. Now, Moses was God's chosen leader. And on both those occasions, God struck them down. Then we go to the New Testament, we find another example in Acts chapter 5. I don't know if you remember Ananias and Sapphira. These are people who lied to the church about their offertory. And the Apostle Peter said, lying to the church is the same as lying to the Holy Spirit. And they died immediately. God struck them down. So it's really fascinating that we find that at the beginning of the nation of Israel and the beginning of the church, God struck people down. And we find the same thing happening at the beginning of the monarchy. All right, so David is the very first Israelite king who will have a successor on the throne. And the events of 2 Samuel 6 teach that king and his people something they will not quickly forget. And the thing that God is teaching them is the gospel. The interesting thing is that if we think God is being harsh with Uzzah and Mikkel in this passage, then perhaps we need reminding of the gospel as well. And I've got 4 points to help us do this morning. You can see on the sermon outline, we're going to set the scene by looking at David's celebration. And then we're going to look at the first mistake that's made in this passage, which is Uzzah's irreverence. This then leads to point three, with David's realization, he's learning something, followed by the second mistake in this passage, which is Mikkel's scorn. And through these 4 points, my prayer is that we will be reminded afresh of what God's people throughout the ages continue to forget. And that is the gospel. So, David's celebration, Uzzah's irreverence, David's realization, and Mikkel's scorn. So let's dive in. And we need a quick background check on where we're at, because we've skipped a couple of chapters in this sermon series. So in 2 Samuel 2 to 2 Samuel 5, that's the story of David finally becoming the crowned king of all of Israel. And he cements his rule by capturing Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and he makes it his capital. It's a great place to have a capital on a hill. Then he defeats not one but two Philistine incursions. All right, so that's the opening of his kingdom. As soon as that happens, the very first thing he does after that, and this is today's passage, is to bring the ark back to Jerusalem. Now, for those not familiar, the ark was a large box coated and decorated in gold. that God had commanded Moses to make at Mount Sinai, okay? So the Ten Commandments were housed in this box, but that wasn't why it was special. It was special because it was to signify God's presence with his people. It was sometimes said that it was God's footstool. All right, that's where he met with his people. And the ark was to be kept at the tabernacle, which was where God drew near to his people. But here's the thing. Ever since 1 Samuel 4, the ark has not been in the tabernacle. So it was actually captured when the Israelites took it out of the tabernacle and took it to war with them. And it was captured by the Philistines, who then returned the ark because God inflicted the Philistines with some really gross diseases. And when it was returned to Israelite territory, if you go back and read in 1 Samuel 6 and 7, 70 Israelites of that Israelite town looked in the ark and were subsequently struck down by God. Another example of God striking people down. And so the Israelites, in their fear, they took the ark to one of the closest houses they could find, just down the road. That was the house of Abinadab. Now, I've heard this described as dumping toxic waste in someone's backyard, right? This thing has just killed 70 people, so you look after it for us, please. And for some 20 years, we're told that the ark stayed there on the outskirts of Israelite life. It played no major role in Israelite life or worship. And David said, we need to fix this. We need to bring God and therefore the ark back into the center of Israelite life and worship. And we need to understand that forgetting the ark for 20 years would be like the church forgetting the cross for 20 years. And so two thumbs up to David here. He's doing a good thing. And he does it in spectacular fashion. We see in verse 1, David brought together able-bodied men of Israel, 30,000 people. And he brings, he hosts this enormous parade in the Lord's honor. We read, have a look at verse 5. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. Friends, this is a good thing. Do you understand that singing praises to God with all our might is what heaven is going to be? Right? Go and have a look at Revelation 4 and 5 again. This is a good thing. So why is it that on any given Sunday here at Erwood Anglican, somewhere between 25 to 50% of our congregation often turn up 10 minutes after the service has started? Now, please don't take this as a rebuke for people here today. Hear me out on this, okay? I'm not trying to slap you on the wrist. But what I'm saying is there's a problem under there. And the problem is the only reason we would not be here early because the first 10 to 15 minutes of our service is spent singing praises to God. Okay, that's what we do. The only reason you would not be here early for that is if you don't enjoy it. I mean, think about it. If you're going to the movies or a play or a footy game, we always get there early, don't we? Because we don't want to miss a bit of this awesome thing that we're there to enjoy. And so if we're missing the praise section of our service, it must be that we're not enjoying it. And if we don't enjoy it, then it must be because we're not doing it right. I mean, the first 10 to 15 minutes of our church service, that's supposed to be a little taste of heaven. If you're not enjoying heaven, then there's something wrong with us, isn't there? Let me tell you, friends, while they might do other things wrong, Hillsong, I think, is much closer to the mark than we are in this. They love singing praises to God. Now, that may be because their music is better than most rock concerts. That's true, but that actually shouldn't matter. You see, singing praises to God is not primarily about the music. It's primarily about God. So the way we are, I think, going to be able to emulate the Israelites here is not to wait for a better band or better music. It is to focus on God. That's what we should be doing. The whole point of singing praises to God is to focus on the words we're singing and allow the truths of those words to just explode in our soul. That's what praise is meant to be. So please don't hear that as a rebuke. Hear it as a way that we can actually do it better so that we enjoy it, so that we want to be here to sing praises to God. That's what it's doing. It is an outward expression of our delight in our ultimate treasure. And that's what the Israelites are doing. All right, it's an awesome scene. The whole house of Israel is celebrating with all their might. Why then does it go so horribly wrong? Have a look at verse 6. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. Now here's the thing. David is well-intentioned here. He wants to celebrate God being brought back into the center of Israelite life and worship. And Uzzah is well-intentioned here. Right? He didn't want this sacred artifact to fall to the ground. How disrespectful that would be. But friends, good intentions don't necessarily mean good practice. God had actually given the Israelites a handbook on how to handle the ark back in Numbers 4. So have a look with me. This is from Numbers chapter 4, where when the camp is to move, so this is the Israelites wandering in the desert for 40 years, okay. When the camp is to move, Aaron and his sons are to go in and take down the shielding curtain and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. Then they are to cover this with hides of sea cows, spread a cloth of solid blue over that, and put the poles in place. So whenever the ark was to be removed from the tabernacle, it was to be covered with three layers so that no one would touch it. Then we read further down in verse 15, after Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, and when the camp is ready to move, the Kohathites, so that's one of the tribes of Levi, the clans of Levi, the Kohathites are to come and do the carrying, but they must not touch the holy things or they will die. Friends, Uzzah was not supposed to be anywhere near the ark. And on top of that, the ark was never supposed to be put on a cart. It was supposed to be carried by those specially consecrated for that job. Yet this is not what Uzzah and David did wrong. What Uzzah and David did wrong, and look, this is the first half of what God is teaching his people in this passage, was that they forgot why these rules were set in place. And the reason the holy things were to be covered was the same reason for the cleanliness laws, and it was the same reason for the sacrificial laws. And that is that God is a holy God, and we are sinful. And what that means is our sin separates us from this holy God. Friends, this is the first half of the gospel. Sin is serious. And because of our sin, you and I cannot come into the presence of a holy God. You see, Uzzah's problem was he thought that the ark would be defiled if it touched the ground, when in actual fact the ark would be defiled if it touched him. Please understand, God is not being overly harsh with Uzzah here. God is just being God. Just like paper and fire cannot coexist together, one will be consumed by the other, so too can sinful humans not coexist with a holy God. Right, so the first thing we must understand about this passage is that God is not being overly harsh here. He is simply being a holy God. Sadly, it took the death of Uzzah for David to start to understand this. We see it in verse 9. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me?" David realizes he is sinful. And this sin meant he could not stand in the presence of a holy God. And so again, they find the nearest house they can find, the one of Obed-Edom, and they drop this weapon of mass destruction off in his back room. However, this is only half the lesson that God is teaching David here. All right, so the first half of the gospel is we are sinful, way more sinful than we ever dare admit. The second half of the gospel is we are loved, way more loved than we ever dreamed possible. Have a look at verse 12. Now, King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God." Now, we suspect this blessing was heaps of babies, either human or livestock, okay? And through this blessing, David realizes, wait a minute, God actually wants me to draw near to him. He wants to be near us, right? We just have to do it in the proper way. And so David tries again. And this time around, verse 13, when those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. So David's read the manual, all right? We learn from the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 15 that he got the Levites to do the carrying. Good work, David. And when they had taken six steps, now what's going on there? Seven is the number of completion, okay? So in taking six steps, they're basically saying we haven't yet started out. Before we start out, we need to do something. And what is that something we need to do? Offer a sacrifice. What's the purpose of the sacrifice? It is to say that like paper is destroyed when it comes into contact with fire, so too should I be destroyed when I come into contact with a holy God. But God, in his infinite love, has allowed something else to be destroyed in my place. And as students of the New Testament will know, the blood of bulls and goats is not sufficient to get us into the presence of God in heaven. Something bigger is needed. At the cross, God struck down his only beloved Son so that we can come into his presence. Right, that's the second half of the gospel. We are more loved than we ever dreamed, imagined. Now, some don't like hearing that. I heard this morning at the 8 o'clock service, they said, God struck down his Son? Well, that's not right, is it, Brendan? The reason they say that is because, well, God didn't really do anything hard then, did he? He just left Jesus to do all the hard work, the dying. But there was a movie this year, you've probably heard of it, it's the biggest blockbuster of the year. It's Infinity War. You may not have seen it. But in the movie Infinity War, the directors wanted to investigate this theme of sacrifice with their superheroes. If you've ever seen a superhero movie, you will know that the superheroes put their own lives on the line, right? They sacrifice themselves in order to fight tyranny. But in Infinity War, the directors flipped it around. And so there's one character called Wanda who is asked to kill her boyfriend, her beloved, so that the baddie won't get the weapon that is attached to him. And the actress, Elizabeth Olsen, this is the scene, does an amazing job of expressing the untellable anguish of having to actually kill your loved one. Now, if you turn that up by about a million, that's what God went through on the cross. He had to strike down his only beloved Son so that he could swap places with us. That's the reason it's called the good news. Gospel is good news. It's because God did all that. He went through infinite anguish for you and me, because he wants us to come into his presence so that he can bless us. And that's the second half of the passage that God wants to teach us. Yes, we are sinful, but we are also loved. Friends, we will know that this has started to sink in when we start to respond like David. In verse 16, we are told that David was leaping and dancing before the Lord. He's happy, right? He's celebrating. In verse 17, he offers fellowship offerings to the Lord, not for sin this time, but for thanksgiving, for the fellowship that he is now allowed to have with this loving God. And then we read in verse 18, after he'd finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd, both men and women. So he is so overwhelmed with joy at this that he just wants to share that joy. Now, what does a loaf of bread cost these days? $3, let's say, about that. Add to that a muffin and a cupcake, about $2.50 each. So we're talking $8 per person, times that by 30,000 people. David has just given out some $250,000 worth of groceries out of his own pocket. Now, why does he do this? Well, firstly, because money is not his ultimate treasure. God is. But second, David wants the whole house of Israel to be delighting in this moment. Friends, I just sometimes feel that we Anglicans don't get this. Right? We're known as the frozen chosen when it comes to singing praises. My concern is that we are grossly undervaluing the importance of feeling and expressing joy in the Lord. Now, the reason I say grossly undervaluing is because it's the meaning of life, remember. It's the number one thing in existence, to enjoy Him forever. That's why we're here. As it turns out, there's an Anglican in our story. Have a look at verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." Now, some people think that going around naked, or half naked, sorry, is a reference to how David may have inadvertently flashed some of the slave girls. I don't think that's what's going on. What's going on is, Michal said, he's taken off his royal robes and he's wearing nothing but a linen ephod, which we learned in verse 14. Michal's issue here is that David is not acting like a king. That term vulgar fellow just means commoner. All right, there are still many royal etiquettes in today's royal family. Did you know, I looked this up during the week, did you know that the order of succession must also always be followed in the royal family. So if they're walking down the street, all right, Harry and Meghan must walk behind Will and Kate, who must walk behind Prince Charles. Not just for official processions, but just walking down the street. I heard another weird one. Did you know that at official dinners, when the Queen has finished eating, when she has her last mouthful, everyone else at the table must stop eating? Weird, eh? But that's the royal etiquette as they've got it. Now, here's the thing. There was royal etiquette back in those days. And Michal is trying to remind David of this. She's saying, David, dancing in the street like a commoner brings dishonor to your office of king. But what Michal fails to realize is that there's something more important than honoring the kingship. Verse 21, David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord, who, by the way, chose me rather than your father or anyone from your household when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes, but by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." Now, what's the difference between David and Michal here? It's that God's grace has sunk into David's heart. Right? He knows that the only reason he can come into the presence of the Lord Almighty is because God has invited him to do so and has paved the way to allow him to do so. By all rights, he should be consumed. But God took care of that through sacrifice. And David has been so impacted by the gospel of grace that he knows that his honor, his dignity, his reputation is of absolutely no value. He doesn't care about that anymore. It has faded into the background compared to honoring God. The reason God strikes Michal with childlessness may very well be that God did not want Michal raising up an heir to the throne that doesn't get grace. So who did he choose instead? Bathsheba, the adulteress we're going to learn about in a couple of weeks' time, who repented and was forgiven. Bathsheba knew about grace. And so God wanted her to raise a child in that household. But friends, here's the thing. If David danced at God's grace before the cross, what are we to do? Now, please don't hear me advocating for dancing and doing cartwheels in the aisle during the next song. In 1 Corinthians 12, the Apostle Paul says we should not do things that distract others from their worship. But that leaves a whole bunch of stuff, doesn't it? Can I just say, I have enormous respect for people who just focus on God. They raise their hands, they dance in their spot. They don't care about their own reputation anymore. They don't care about what people might think. Oh, he's a little charismatic. Who cares? I'm worshiping God. That's what's number one. Friends, may we ignore our dignity and focus on God at those times. Let's preach. How are we going to do that? We're going to do that by preaching the gospel to ourselves each and every day. All right? Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of this world, like our reputation, will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace.